Some of the deals involved the country's rich, underdeveloped vein of extra-heavy oil in the Orinoco River Basin, which lay in Venezuela's wet coastlands to the east, near Guyana. The Orinoco River snaked 1,300 miles to the Caribbean through tropical palms and slash-and-burn agricultural fields. The United States Geological Survey estimated that the basin held between 380 billion and 650 billion barrels of recoverable oil, perhaps double Saudi Arabia's endowment. This vast reserve lay beneath the river basin's muddy soil, but the petroleum was unusually viscous and contaminated. American, Canadian, and European oil companies had begun to experiment by the late 1990s with new technologies that could efficiently upgrade heavy oil near wellheads and refine it to a lighter blend suitable for international markets. Mobil was a leader in the field. Its Latin American executives opened talks with Venezuela's oil ministry about an Orinoco heavy oil project in 1991 and finalized a contract 6 years later. The deal was known as the Cerro Negro Association Agreement. There were four such associations created to mine Orinoco's reserves: Total of France, Statoil of Norway, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, and BP all participated, either as operators or as minority holders. Mobil's civil engineers cleared a muddy expanse in a valley surrounded by thickly forested mountains and erected an upgrader, a modest word to describe a facility that, when completed, would resemble in visual dimension the vast refineries of northern New Jersey. Its pipes, flaring smokestacks, and white oval storage tanks soon formed a gleaming, belching industrial park in the midst of eastern Venezuela's rural poverty. Construction proceeded during the Exxon merger. After first oil flowed, senior executives from Irving, including Rex Tillerson, proudly flew in by jet and helicopter to inspect the achievement. "Exxon was extremely proud," recalled a U.S. government official who toured the facility. "This was the new frontier, the first time anything on this scale had been tried. It worked. It was totally new. It had been a big risk." Hugo Chavez read and espoused the usual Latin American Marxist-influenced texts, but he saw himself as a synthesizer of old and new political ideas. Chavez later said he was gullible and believed he might be able to construct a mixed capitalist and socialist system. The ambiguous remarks he made about business and ideology during his early years in power led some international oil companies to think they might yet be able to hold on to the oil deals they had made during the opening of the 1990s. Gradually, however, Chavez moved more forcefully against his domestic opponents, and as oil prices gyrated and the economy deteriorated, he grew desperate for new sources of revenue. The president purged PDVSA of engineers and technocrats he regarded as hostile to his regime. He fired about 12,000 employees, mostly executives and administrative staff, after the company participated in a national strike called to bring him down. He replaced the ousted managers with political cadres who tacked Che Guevara posters on their office walls and whose knowledge of oil production and accounting was often limited or non-existent. He looted PDVSA for revenue. The company handed over about 70% of its gross revenue to the Chavez regime in 2006, including about $10 billion for social spending projects. In a year when most global oil companies posted record profits, PDVSA lost an estimated $3.7 billion. To stay afloat, Chavez authorized mass borrowing, $4 billion from China, in exchange for special access to Venezuelan oil, and another $6 billion from international bond and financial markets. He cut oil production and supply deals with Syrian, Iranian, Indian, and Indonesian corporations. By the time of the ExxonMobil art wars, Chavez was running PDVSA like a political Ponzi scheme. He overpromised to his impoverished Venezuelan followers, then milked the oil industry's revenue to pay for those promises as best he could. Chavez railed to his followers about the low royalty rates paid to Venezuela by ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, Total, Statoil, and other international majors during the 1990s, when he had been in opposition. ExxonMobil's complex at Cerro Negro, one of several similar joint ventures in the Orinoco region, enjoyed a royalty rate of just 1% during the project's early years of production. That low rate, distinct from the corporate taxes the government collected, which were substantial, had been agreed upon by Venezuela to assure Mobil that it could recoup the investments in the upgrader complex before Venezuela took a larger share of revenue. After 9 years, the royalty rate would rise to 16.67%, but that event still lay years away. Chavez started to pressure the international oil companies over their royalty deal soon after he won his referendum, the victory ExxonMobil had aided. He threatened to unilaterally bring forward the 16.67% rate. The companies cannot be sure whether or how quickly Chavez would act. The U.S. Embassy cabled Washington that ExxonMobil, presumably looking at potential risks around the world, had declared privately and repeatedly that it takes sanctity of contract very seriously. Yet the corporation had invested $1.5 billion in its Orinoco operations and planned to spend at least $700 million more over the contract's 35-year life. Would it really dare to pull out of Venezuela a second time, and so early in the project's tenure, before profits had flowed amply? Norm Coleman, a Republican senator from Minnesota, traveled to Caracas and met ExxonMobil executive Mark Ward. Coleman noted that the other international oil giants had decided not to protest Chavez's initial probes on the royalty issue. ExxonMobil, perhaps, has a different perspective on contract sanctity than other companies, Ward replied. For ExxonMobil, the sanctity of contracts is paramount. The mixed messages sent by different companies, some accommodating, others defiant, created difficulties, Coleman said. Ward answered that the other companies operating in Venezuela had been blackmailed by Chavez. Their oil holdings in the country were in some cases more important to their global reserve reporting than was the case for huge, diversified ExxonMobil. Such brave talk would soon be tested. Chavez drifted through 2006 and never forced the royalty issue. But as an election scheduled for December of that year approached, he went after the Orinoco deals in full bore. He had committed himself to massive social spending, and he lacked financing options. "We are moving toward a socialist republic of Venezuela, and that requires a deep reform of our national constitution," he announced. "We are heading toward socialism, and nothing and no one can prevent it."